Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
No, I promise continuity. I'll behave myself. I'll do all the lines we rehearsed, you know. That's the thing, you know. I have a reputation for being sort of controversial and irreverent and also the semantic bear trap of bad taste. And actually, I do have, and I will always be accused of bad taste by the people who eat in restaurants to reserve service, you know, that kind of scene to anyone, yeah. But you might be interested in how I became offensive. Like, started in school with drinking and... I was like a real depressed kid, you know, 7 or 8 years old, and I really get juiced and get out of my life.
So that was the words, the sound of Lenny Bruce, the real Lenny Bruce. And I thought it was such a perfect clip. That was from the, I think, the Steve Allen show. But that was a perfect clip because trying to find a clip where Lenny did not use foul language is a difficult thing to do. But fortunately, he is brought to life now at the Royal George Theater in a show called I'm Not a Comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce. And joining me is the playwright and the actor of this one-man show. So happy to have him here. I saw the show. It is absolutely amazing. Ronnie Marmo, the very talented man, is with us. Ronnie, good to have you with me.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you so much. And I love that clip. Yeah, that was from Steve Allen. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, people
thank
will know
you very much.
You yourself have been in more than 60 movies and TV shows, Criminal Minds, Lethal Weapons. You're a director yourself. But also joining us is the director from this show, a very well-known name and face in the Chicago area, Joe Mantegna, Tony Award-winning, Jeff Award-winning from Glengarry Glen Ross, which, Joe, you and I go back to. I saw you in that many years ago. He, of course, plays FBI agent David Rossi in Criminal Minds, Godfather 3, but all your credits don't add up to the one main role you've had in your career, and that's Fat Tony in the Simpsons. So I think that's probably the key thing. I know you're hang your hat on. Hi, Joe.
It's certainly my longest running role. Yeah,
yeah. Was it like,
I've been doing it for 29 years.
Unbelievable. Can you phone it in from home, or you got to go into a studio?
No, I still show up.
Okay.
It's all good.
So this incredible project, let me go. I mean, you wrote this, Ronnie, so you not only performed, you wrote it. It's when I went to see it, I thought, I don't know, who wants to know about Lenny Bruce today? And then I realized why we need to. But what was the impetus to your creating this story these days?
Well, you know, it is it's very timely, as you know, and you probably saw it during the show. It's like really actually necessary, I feel. But that wasn't what originally turned me on. I was doing someone else's play, which I loved, but we weren't doing the material. It was called Lenny's Back and Boy Is He Pissed. And we were telling stories about Lenny. It was someone else's script. And I had a beautiful time with it. But then at some point I realized, like, I feel like there's so much more to say. And so I went off to write my own, and I got the rights to the material from Kitty Bruce. And as I dug deeper, I fell more in love with this guy and realized the importance of him today. And then it became very timely, and I think I looked smarter now than I intended to be, actually. But I appreciate that. And I don't know. I love this guy, and I think it's necessary. So.
Well, and for people who, listen, depending on the age of the audience, the night I was there, you had some younger people, some older people. You know, I go back to, I was around when Lenny Bruce, I was a young kid when Lenny Bruce was alive, so I don't really remember him. But for those people who are fans of George Carlin and so many of the greats today and yesteryear, Sam Kinison, you can go on, it all started with Lenny Bruce, right, Joe?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you could add Richard Pryor to that list, Dick Gregory.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
He was at the forefront for all of it. And in a way, it's almost more apropos and timely today than it even was, let's say, even 5 years ago. Because if anything, our First Amendment rights are starting to be eroded. And I mean, I understand there's a lot of... you know, there's all these different things about freedom of speech and also how far can you go with certain things and certain words and all this and the other. But I think we're starting in a way to get into dangerous territory of actually inhibiting, you know, our ability to even just converse with each other. I mean, there's a line in the play where Lenny even says, he says, it's just words.
Yeah.
These are just words. And... It's funny. Here we are in the 21st century, you know, well into it, and we're in a way almost sliding back to way, you know, even things were in the 1950s, you know, the 1950s.
You know, and Ronnie, as I sat there, I was sitting in the front row, and I didn't want to take notes. There were lines that were coming up all the time that I thought, boy, I want to write this down just to kind of bring it up. But Joe was making a great point, which is there is a point in the show where you're in court because Lenny Bruce got arrested every night and had to deal with that. And he sort of said, I thought this was great. This was truly a George Carlin federal case moment. I'm a lawyer as well, which was, of course, his seven dirty words routine. The court ultimately finding, look, you can't do that. Online, you can't do that on free radio because it's uniquely obtrusive into the home. But you know what? These days, cable, satellite radio, people pay to bring them in. They can listen to what they want. And you made that point. Lenny Bruce made that point. I imagine you went back to court records to sort of say people are coming. No one's forcing them to come into the club. They're paying to see me. Why can't I say what I want?
1,000,000%. I did get those actual, you know, words from transcripts. And he also makes the point about the stripper, which I think is brilliant. Every night when I do that, I actually get upset about it, thinking about what Lenny went through, because he was right. You can go see a stripper in a private place and pay for that, and that's perfectly legal and acceptable. But you can't do that for Lenny Bruce when, you know, people were coming and paying and having their own experience. So it was frustrating. I mean, it just shows me that they made an example of him, and the rules weren't the same for everyone, you know? And he was just a little too smart, I think, and I don't think they appreciated the fact that, you know, he was pushing the envelope and they want to stay in the envelope. So, you know.
Yeah, and again, the lesson's so important for today. Now, Joe, Ronnie is a director, so I suppose he, you know, could have pulled a Jerry Lewis and done everything without you. But you guys worked together. Actually, Joe, did you guys meet in Criminal Minds, or did your relationship go back prior to that?
No, it went back quite a bit further beyond prior to that, in a sense that Ronnie, you know, had started this theater company out here in Los Angeles, and he contacted me quite a few years ago about possibly doing a small part in the movie he had written. And I was taken by the script, and I was just taken by because I thought the script was interesting. So I said, yeah, I'll meet with you. Let's talk about this. And then when I met him, I have to say, I saw a little of myself, you know, 20 years earlier. In other words, I felt, okay, this is like a young version of me. You know, a young Italian kid. He came out of New York. I came out of Chicago. We come to Los Angeles. He's trying to do some theater. They're trying to get ahead. They're trying to make something. And I respected that. And so I was like, you know what? Let's take a shot at this. I did the movie. Wound up then directing a play at his theater, and that ultimately led to us doing Lenny. But him being on Criminal Minds, I had nothing to do with it. The casting director of Criminal Minds came to see it. Because, of course, I was telling everybody at the show, I said, oh, if you get a chance, please come see this play. She came and saw it, and she was knocked out by Ronnie's performance. And so she brought him in, and the very first thing she brought him in on, this director, who was actually from Germany, saw his audition and just cast him immediately without I had nothing to do with it, in other words. But that's how it's supposed to be. I mean, Ronnie is carving his own path, and this role is a perfect showcase.
Oh, yeah, and you can just see that you guys run our WGN morning show, and just the dynamics between you, the relationship, you can see the friendship and how you guys get along. So I know that had to help. You know, Ronnie, there's a bit you do early on in the show, and it was one of Lenny Bruce's bit, and it involves the N-word. And you make this point, and I think this is you scripting it, because you said, and this is sort of coming to present day, you sort of told the audience, you're going to be more uncomfortable hearing this now than when I first did this routine, and you use the N-word. And it's true, isn't it? I mean, I can tell you, sitting as an audience member, you hear the words and you cringe. But I thought when he did it back in the 50s or 60s, what was the reaction then?
Well, you know, here's the thing about that. You're right. Joe and I got together and we were very careful. We had a sensitive and gentle hand with scripting this little intro to that bit, because of course we're sensitive to the word and we understand what it means. But at the same time, we were feeling like if we're going to do Lenny Bruce, if we don't include all of it, and we're talking about a historical figure here, then what we're doing is we're putting tape over his mouth again, and people are either going to learn about this man or they're not. And so, and we understood the bit. And so, you know, here's the best way I can explain it. The people in the 50s and 60s, especially the African-American community, they loved Lenny, and they got it. Dick Gregory called him the eighth wonder of the world after he heard the bit. He said he's the eighth wonder of the world. So what I find interesting today is I get a little more heat and not understanding from the white community than I do from the African-American community, because they get it. And the people who I'm explaining the people who Lenny Bruce was defending back then are the people I'm explaining now who he was. It's kind of bizarre. It's kind of like the very people he was defending and they got it are the people who don't get it now.
This story may or may not make sense to you, but Jean-Claude Baker, who owned a restaurant called Chez Josephine in New York, recently he passed away. But anyway, he talked about the fact that when his mother died, the great Josephine Baker, he was very upset. And when Lena Horne died, very upset that certain people didn't go to the funeral. The stars of today, the people who for whom Josephine Baker, Lena Horne paved the way, didn't go to the funeral. I'm sort of curious, is that kind of thing today? Lenny Bruce paved the way for so many comedians and they don't even get it today?
Well, the comics, I haven't really ran into much heat from comics. I think they get it. To be honest with you, I'm a little worried, and I haven't really shared this anywhere. This thought came to me a few days ago. I'm a little worried that the way we're going with like guys like Jerry Seinfeld being booed off stage at a college, that comedy may become extinct here soon. I mean, I've heard some really big celebrity comics say they're not going to get on stage anymore. They don't need the stress in this time we're in. They'd rather just count their money and live in the house they're comfortable in and not lose everything. So, you know, I don't know what to say. I mean, so far the comics have supported it and they've appreciated it. I haven't gotten a lot of heat. I don't want to make it sound like it's been a big problem. But I do think the world we're living in today, especially with a lot of the millennial, you know, young guys and girls, they'd rather not have a hard conversation. And I think that specific bit and others in the show force us to discuss things that potentially, you know, we'd rather just brush under the rug, you know?
Yeah. Joe, in directing this show, you know, in many ways, it's a lighting comment I'm making. There's very darkness to it. It opens up. I don't mean to be giving anything away, but Lenny Bruce is found at the end of his life. And I think most people know you're not dressed when we see you in that scene. And then the role of the lighting and all of that. Talk to me about, as a director, from your perspective, bringing that sort of light of the character into the darkness that you worked with in terms of the staging. One guy, a few chairs, yeah. a glass, a magazine. I mean, that's it.
Right. Well, for me, the good thing was it was already on the page. In other words, I thought Ronnie had done a brilliant job of writing the script. And my feeling was what hopefully I brought to it, what it needed, was just that kind of direction, which is, you know, apropos to being the director, in the sense that when Ronnie first performed it for me, in fact, he did it by, he opened it by doing the N-word bit. That's how he opened it. And then went on.
Yeah, Joe was like, no way, man, we're not doing that.
Yeah. And when I saw the whole script and I saw him perform it, I said, okay, I think what we've written is great. But I said, we got to move some stuff around. We've got to tell the story differently. And so he had, in the script, he told about how he was found, you know, when he passed away.
Right.
And so I thought, that's how we have to start it. Let's do a thing where we start at the end, tell the story, and go back. In other words, let's do a circle. And it says, because they've got to learn about you. They've got to like you. They've got to understand, not necessarily like you, but they've got to accept you before you can start hitting them with the, you know, with the howitzer. We'll start hitting them with the material that's really somewhat explosive. And then hopefully that's what we've done in the sense of that we start at the end, you know, which is shocking enough. And then he starts to take you back and tells you the story. And so I moved everything around in terms of let's tell the, you know, start at the beginning. Let's talk about your mother. Let's talk about your who became your wife. Let's talk about your child. Then let's get into the legal stuff. And then that way we see the whole evolution of Lenny's life from end back to the beginning, back to the end. And so for me, that it was just that. I mean, that was my main contribution, but the material was already all there. I mean, I don't think I added, you know, one word to the dialogue. Ronnie kept coming up with other little bits and things that we would, you know, shift around and move around. But it was all there. It was just a matter of, so I just thought, for me, it was a perfect collaboration of the performer, who was also the writer, and me being able to direct it. So I
Paul,
that way.
Yeah, I want to add, Paul, is that Joe's being modest. I mean, he did so much. Definitely the dramaturgy of the script. He took it the final 30 yards I thought it needed. Moving, he was so smart with moving things around. But also, you know, when you're doing a one-man show, a lot of these, when you write your own one-man show, a lot of times they fall flat because people just know what they want. They know it's got to be this, it's got to be that. And sometimes that doesn't work, you know. And the reason I was so blessed to have Joe involved is because I admire and respect Joe's talent so much. And personally, my personal feelings for Joe, that I knew that, like, there would be one or two things I would, you know, fight for, and the rest is like, okay, sounds good, because I, you know, it's like if I got one of my friends to do it, you know, I maybe would have just kept some stuff I thought was the right idea. So he was really instrumental.
I think it's also true, Ronnie, that, you know, if all this show did was reenact Lenny Bruce's life, this could not sustain. I mean, there has to be a deeper purpose, and it's as though you started this with the deeper purpose. But we do get Lenny Bruce with you. You play with the audience, and my guess is, and I don't know, maybe Joe kind of helped direct that, but the night I was there, you had people who played along with you and stuff. But is that ever a risk? Do you ever work with people in the audience at night? You don't put them on the spot too much, but, you know, a little bit you involve them where people turn on you, or it's tough to deal with, which Lenny Bruce, I'm sure, had to deal with.
Well, here's the thing. Two things. First of all, where were you sitting, Paul?
I was front row, stage left.
Okay, stage left. Okay, that's so okay.
I tried to get you to come over to me and play with me, but I couldn't get you to do that.
Sorry. Well, here's the thing. This is going to sound kind of silly, but at the beginning of my career, I did this play for 2 years, Tony and Tina's Wedding.
Sure.
And it was my first paid job, and a lot of it was this interaction. So I learned quickly, and I actually figured out how, like, who wanted to play quickly and who doesn't. So I could see somebody and within a split second know if they're willing to participate or not. There are people I walk right past because I could see they don't want anything to do with it. So those three bits that I bring out to the audience, I leave room in there to see where I'm at and play a little bit. But I quickly can assess. And there have been people who I was wrong about who didn't want to play. And then there's a few people who can't stop playing in inappropriate times, and I have to shush them, you know. They want to be in the show, and you know, sometimes I have to clear that up. But overall, it's all instincts. I don't know if Joe, I don't know if you like that section. We've never really talked about, but endears Lenny.
No, I love it, and not only do I love it, I know Lenny would have loved it, because it's that moment in the play, it's those moments in the play where it stops being, we step out of the play a little bit, and it becomes real. That's the difference between live theater and film and television anyway, where now all of a sudden you're dealing with reality and present time and real people. So I think, Ronnie, you've been doing these performances long enough now. You have that rapport with the audience, and I think those moments are fantastic, because that's what makes every single night that you do it a little different than the night before. Because those moments, the other stuff's going to always be there, but you never know how those moments are going to go. And some nights, are like explosive and unbelievable, and some are like, okay, they are what they are, but they never just sit there. They're always going to have some sort of impact. And so I think it's necessary that we have that, even if it's probably less than 5% of the show. But that 5% is total improvisation on your part, depending on what the audience is saying and doing with you. And I just think it's fantastic, because that tells you, you now own that role. You've done it over 200 plus times. And, you have the capability and the license to do what you do.
And actually, I have a follow-up for Joe, but given what Joe just said, Ronnie, I'm going to come back to you for a moment. Have you watched, I just started watching this, and I only started watching this, to be honest, because of Lenny Bruce, but this new, the Amazon show, the The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel?
Marvelous Maisel, yep.
Have you watched
it? I've seen a few episodes, and I like it. I think it's really good. You know, here's the thing, that guy Luke Kirby, who's playing Lenny Bruce, is a very good actor, you know? I wish they would give him a little more to do, but the show's not about Lenny Bruce. But I do love how much awareness it's bringing Lenny, you know, to the public. I mean, people are talking about Lenny Bruce. We have a lot of younger people coming to the show because of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and some of them don't know that Lenny was an actual person. They go, oh, I thought he was a, you know, fictitious character, and they're shocked to find out that who he actually was. So I love the fact that he's, you know, he's brought so much, that show's brought so much attention to Lenny, and it just means the world to me and Kitty Bruce and the show. It's just fantastic, you know.
Actually, they're probably shocked to find out Mrs. Maisel isn't real, but they'll get over
right.
that.
Well, I think she's Joan Rivers, actually. Oh. That's That's my interpretation.
That's an interesting point.
Because Joan Rivers loved Lenny Bruce, and there was a whole thing. And so I think it's Joan Rivers. That's my interpretation.
I will think about that as I watch this now. Joe, when I think, I mean, just stage, movies, television, all that you've done, you work with some of the greatest directors, some of the most incredible material. In your director role, I'm not going to ask you what you like doing better, because everything is its own child for you. But who has been an influence for you as you serve the director role, working with other actors, given the folks you've worked with through your career?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. And I have to say, it probably is a compilation of my experience with a whole bunch of different directors. And you're right. I mean, I've worked with Coppola. I've worked with Barry Levinson. I've worked with Woody Allen. I've worked with Mamet. Who's a wonderful writer, director, Steve Zaillian. It's just a compilation of my experience with all these different directors. And I think the key is, if the material is there, there's a saying that I use often, if it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage. Hopefully when it's on the page, as it was with this piece, then the material is already there. And then if you cast it right, and again, that wasn't a problem here, because here I had the man who created it, who does a brilliant job of translating those words into a performance. So then, as a director, my job is just to be that outside eye, to kind of guide the thing. And usually, it's like, to me, it's like when I read a book. When you read the book and you enjoy it, you can't wait to read the next page, and then you're kind of even sad when it ends. It's the same way with something, a piece that I got to direct about 9 episodes of Criminal Minds, which I also enjoyed very much because we had such a good writing staff. But it's that same thing. As you do it, as you read it, you start to visualize things, and things come to your mind like, oh, let's try this, or this might look cool, or that might look cool. And so it's just that. It's just being able to talk to the actor or actors and just give them the freedom to do the voodoo that they do. You know what I mean? In a way, kind of get out of their way.
Yeah.
And just kind of give them, aim them toward a path and say, try this out. And then let them go with it.
As a good director would.
No more than that. So those are the directors that I've, enjoyed working with the most, ones that kind of gave you that freedom. And the great ones do that.
Yeah, and Ronnie, you've mentioned Kitty Bruce a couple of times. Of course, his wife, Honey, she's gone. But Kitty Bruce is still around. I'll be honest with you. I was going to try and surprise you guys and have her part of this conversation today, but I was unsuccessful in doing that. But that being said, she has been a part of this project for you, Ronnie, right?
Well, first of all, it's her birthday.
Oh, no wonder she didn't want to be a part of it.
I forgot to tell you that. Maybe you could call Kitty later. It's her birthday. Kitty has been, from the beginning, she's a champion of this whole thing. You know, she's so proud of this. And she's coming to the performance next Saturday night, if anybody's in town.
Yeah.
I think it's the 16th, whatever that Saturday is. She'll be here at the 8 p.m. show. And she's coming in with 11 family members. That's how proud she is. And listen, what can I say? I mean, to have her support and her love is priceless. And what's beautiful about our show, there's so much information on the show, in our play, that you can't find on Google. And those were very private conversations with Kitty that she has given me the blessing to use, things like the letter and just different things and information and things her dad would say that you don't know unless you know. And so to say she's been a support is, an understatement, right, Joe? I mean,
absolutely. For me, that's the best review of all. The fact that Kitty, I sat with her the first time she saw it in Los Angeles, and to sit there and hold her hand and have her squeeze my hand and then see that occasional tear in her eye and the giggle and her different reactions to Ronnie's performance, to me, that was all the review I needed.
Oh, beautiful. And I know, by the way, she sells T-shirts through the foundation where they bring assistance to folks. You were selling T-shirts at the theater. I'm assuming that's part of the same foundation work?
Yeah, I'm on the board of directors for the Lenny Bruce Memorial Foundation. And what we do is we send people to rehab who don't have insurance. We try to help people find recovery. And so the T-shirts are 100%, 100% of the proceeds go to the foundation, whether you buy them at the show or on LennyBruce.org. And in fact, I'm about to put out to the world in a few minutes, since it's Kitty's birthday, to try to get people to really support that today and help. And it's important work, because so many people are denied an opportunity to find recovery because of insurance. It's ridiculous. So,
all right. And the show is I'm Not a Comedian. I'm Lenny Bruce. It's at the Royal George Theater. You can get tickets at the Royal George Theater, spelled the proper English way, T-R-E at the end of theater.com. So glad they do that. And
Paul, can I suggest that they go to Lenny Bruce on stage?
Sure.
.com, because the Royal George is a great website, but ours is, you could get tickets through our website as well. And what happens is you really could go down a rabbit hole, read all the reviews, see beautiful videos, and just really get a feeling for the show.
LennyBruceOnStage.com, a better place to get your tickets. You know, the running date, Ronnie, what do you think? I know what they're printing, but I'm hoping maybe you stay longer. What should we tell people?
Well, we're scheduled through December 1st, but I would be shocked if we didn't extend. There's been so much discussion about it, and we're so blessed how Chicago, how warmly they're receiving this play. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say I'd be really shocked if we didn't get to go through December. So I think it's going
to
happen.
I hope so. People want to check out you guys again. They can also go to WGNMorningNews.com. You guys were on the morning show when I first said hi to you. And, Ronnie, you're on my Politics Tonight show tomorrow night. So people can also check that clip out after the show as well. And Joe Mantegna, don't be a stranger to Chicago. Come back, too. It's your home.
Oh, it's my hometown. I always get back there. I'm like a homing pigeon.
All right. I love it. All right. LennyBruceOnStage.com. The show is I'm Not a Comedian. I'm Lenny Bruce. Do not miss it. It is just incredible. So powerful and moving. It's why I wanted to see it before I talked to you guys. Ronnie Marmo, the playwright, the actor, Joe Mantegna, one of the world's greatest actors and directors. I thank both of you for being with me. Thank you. And best of luck. Break legs
Our
on the
pleasure.
Show.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Paul.
Hello, Chicago! It's good to be home! If I had told you 8 years ago that America would reverse a great recession, reboot our auto industry, and unleash the longest stretch of job creation in our history, if I had told you that we would open up a new chapter with the Cuban people, shut down Iran's nuclear weapons program without firing a shot, take out the mastermind of 9/11. If I had told you that we would win marriage equality and secure the right to health insurance for another 20 million of our fellow citizens, if I had told y'all that, you might have said our sights were set a little too high.
Well, I think you know who that voice was. It was a very long time ago. But those were the words of President, now former President Barack Obama. It was actually his final speech of his presidency in Chicago. He came back home. I covered that with WGN, and it was quite an emotional moment in a very large arena. But those moments and those years were captured, have been captured by in many ways, but one of which is a book of photography. And nothing is more intimate and more emotional, I think, than looking at photographs of the day when they're taken by somebody who knows what they're doing. And there's a new book called Yes, We Did. Photos and behind-the-scenes stories celebrating our first African-American president, taken by former AP photographer, but he became a White House photographer, part of a staff of five, where he was the only African-American photographer covering President Barack Obama. He is Lawrence Jackson. He joins me now. Lawrence, good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
So folks who want some visual along with this, not only, of course, can get the book, but you've appeared on Politics Tonight. I'd encourage people to go to CLTV.com/Politics Tonight and watch that interview along with many of the photographs that we were able to share. But first, let me take you back in time, because when this all started for you, you weren't a White House photographer who went on to cover the next president from Bush to Obama. You were working for AP, but you had kind of a very interesting moment, and it was the night the president won the election. Tell me about that.
Sure. As you said, election night 2008, I was working for the AP and I was covering the White House with George Bush there. And if he, I was there just for coverage if he decided to make a statement or something on the election results. So when the election was called for President-elect Obama, and there were these kids from American University and George Washington University kind of gathered at Lafayette Park, making all this ruckus and just celebrating. So I grabbed my gear and I went outside and I took pictures of this kind of frenetic, crazy scene. And I was just kind of overwhelmed, you know, by the fact that we just elected an African-American president. The energy in the crowd was so palpable and visceral that, you know, I was walking through a charged electric field, it felt like. So I filed my pictures to the office, and I'm headed home. And this is, at this point, it's around 1 a.m., and I'm walking back through Lafayette Park. And as I get closer to my parking garage, off to my left, there's this black guy. And as we get closer to each other, he finally looks at me and says, "Can you believe it?" And I look at him and I say, "I know, right?" And it was that instant recognition with a complete stranger that we were both so excited and moved by the fact that we had just elected African-American president, something that we knew or felt that would never happen in our lifetime, that I knew that I had to be a part of that administration. So I applied, or I applied to be the chief photographer, and I didn't get it. And then in January 2009, Pete Souza called me up and said, are you interested in working with us? And we talked, and I said, yes, I am.
And the rest, as they say, is history. But you made history, yeah, as you followed the president. You know, the pictures in this book are so magnificent, and I feel like I want to ask you, look, you know, I take pictures with my phone. I've got some great pictures of my dog.
I'm sure you do.
Lawrence, why is it that you, and I don't mean to, you know, blow smoke, but why were you a successful White House photographer more so than I could have been if I was there trying to take pictures? What is it that you bring to the photos?
Well, I brought 20 plus years of photojournalism experience to the job. And, you know, we as photojournalists are trained to capture, you know, moments, be ready for just about anything. And we try to cut through the mess and get to the heart of the story. And then my rule of thumb are three rules. You know, one is I try to get the emotion, of the story. You know, that could be a smile or a tear or just a warm gesture. And if I can't find that, you know, emotion in the image, then I'm looking for just the information in which I'm trying to convey. And that could be, you know, him speaking at a podium and shaking hands, greeting somebody. And if I can't get the information or the emotion, then I'm just, you're really trying to make an aesthetically pleasing picture by using the light that's in the room, by using a different angle, or just, you know, waiting for the right time for a moment.
Of course, you don't get to, you know, at a particular moment, okay, Mr. President, give me a smile, pose. I mean, there may be moments of those, but that's not the magic of what you do. The magic is you're just there doing your job. I'm sort of curious. I haven't asked you this before, but if there's going to be a meeting between the president and somebody or a meeting between Michelle and the president, how many pictures might you take before you end up with the picture? And I realize you'll review them all, but when all said and done, how many are you going through till you'll say, this is the one, this is what captures the moment of history?
Well, it depends on, you know, on the situation. But, you know, it's funny, when I used to shoot film, I felt that a good ratio for a roll of film had 36 exposures. And I felt if I got two or three good images on that roll of film, then that was a good roll of film being used. So that ratio is what, I'm not sure of the math of that, but, you know, given the situation, it depends on what you're going to get. Some, you know, greets and some meetings in the Oval Office, nothing comes of it. Nothing is great, but it's all usable because of that information that I was talking about, because it's important and it's historic.
Now, I know, and you've said to me before, the Obamas were natural subjects for photography. They got it. They knew when you were there what you had to do, and whether they paid attention to you or not, they understood the routine. But, of course, many times you're capturing them with many people who are not as astute terms of being, maybe they're kids, maybe they're just, you know, normal people who are there. Mm-hmm. So was that more difficult when you have to capture moments of just regular old folk who really didn't know what to make of the photographer?
Yeah, well, you're right. There were people who were conscious of the picture being taken, and they kind of made the picture less natural.
They probably looked at you, right? Yeah. Looking at you instead of looking at...
Well, they looked at me and they kind of just get stiff. You know, it's funny. We tell our kids to smile through the camera, right?
Yeah.
And as people grow up, the camera is pointed towards them. They straighten up and they smile and they start looking at the camera. And that's like the worst thing for a photojournalist. You know, you want it to be natural. So with our kids, we never had them say smile. We never said smile for the camera. We just took pictures of them as they were kids. And they were much more natural in front of the camera because of that.
You would go with the Obamas, and not just the Bidens. You covered not just the Obamas. You covered the Bidens and whatever the job happened to be as assigned by, I imagine, Pete Souza, the chief photographer. But you also got to be with them for private moments. One night, I think it was Michelle's birthday. They're out at a restaurant in DuPont called Nora's in 2010. You're there taking pictures. Were there times when they just said, Lawrence, out, back up, you're not part of this? Did they ever do that? And if they did, did you say, but Mr. President, this is history. I can't do that.
Right. So I'll take that story. I'll talk about that picture of the First Lady and her surprise birthday party. So this is fairly early on in the first term. I think it was 2010. And the president kind of knew our role as photographers, but at the same time, he realized that we're all family people, and he wanted us to spend as much time with our families as possible. But the rule of thumb was whenever he stepped off campus, a staff photographer would go with him because you never knew what would happen. So we get to the restaurant, we get out, he greets the friends and family, and I take a few pictures. Then I go hide in a side room and just, you know, sit and talk to some of the staffers. And at some point during the evening, the president, you know, goes to the restroom. He walks by that room and he sees me there and he says to me, "What are you still doing here?" And I said, "You know, sir, I'm here because, you know, just in case you need anything." And he says, "Well, you should be home with those babies." And he walks to the bathroom. And I look at one of my coworkers and I said, "Did he just give me a direct order?" And but it didn't matter if he did or not, because Pete, our boss, was like, you know, "We are going to be there as long as he's there." So I just, you know, I tried to make myself as small as possible. And on his way back to the dining room, he said, "Come on, let's do a group photo." And I think he was doing that just to give me something to do,
right,
which is fine.
Wow.
And I took the picture, and then I go back to that side room, and maybe 15, 20 minutes later, they bring in the cupcake, and they sing her happy birthday, and I flip into the room, and I take that picture, and it's in a book. And it's one of my favorite pictures because she seems so happy and so, you know, just good to be around friends and family for that birthday.
I get the impression that the Obamas treated you with respect. I say that because I'm just going to guess that there are probably some presidents who might deal with photographers and other people as you know, staff people. It's just like, "You're not important. Get out of my way. I'm too important for you." Kind of. I don't get the feelings the Obamas handled you or any of the. I doubt they handled anybody that way.
You are absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. And I'll tell you this: the wait staff, you know, the private resident wait staff. You know, you can judge a lot by the way people talk to and deal with, you know, people that are serving them on a day-to-day basis. And you'll find no one in that White House wait staff will say a bad word about them because, you know, the president and first lady, they knew their family's names. They knew their kids' names. They knew, you know, everything about them because they had conversations with them just like normal people do.
Were there places that were off limits for you? I mean, like the private residence. I don't. There's no pictures in your book of showing Barack and Michelle waking up in the morning and getting out of the president. So, are there places that you just did not go and could not go?
Well, there. You know, I don't think I think that's the wrong way to look at it. I think it's like, you know, they understood that we had a job and that we were there to cover anything that they wanted covered. But when it comes to them, you know, getting up out of bed, no. I think they were pretty good. They didn't need that covered.
Okay. Just asking.
Yeah.
When you look back on those years, was there a moment, an event where you were there taking photos? And I mean, everything is history, but were there moments, you know, as you know, history itself has, there's certain iconic photos that take us through time that we just don't forget. Are there moments that you covered where you went, "This will never be forgotten"?
Hello?
Yeah.
You said moments when there were times?
I'm saying, were there moments that you were at an event or something where you said, these photos will never be forgotten? This truly is going to be iconic for the history books.
Yeah. Well, there are pictures that you feel that are fairly strong and you hope will make it or will stand the test of time. You know, in my book, there's a picture of Alan Gross, you know, pumping his fist in the air after the pilot announces that they have just crossed Cuban airspace. And that moment, you know, kind of symbolizes so much about, you know, that moment of, you know, the restart of Cuba-U.S. relations, which, and the, you know, this man who had been in prison for 5 years and, you know, just his excitement and the revelation that, you know, he's going home. And I, you know, it's so funny, when I took that picture, I thought to myself, you know, this picture is going to be in a history book someday, you know? Mm. And that, you know, that's a pretty special feeling.
I imagine you talk about the Obamas and their relationship with staff and their families. In the book, we get to see the fact that the Obamas met your family. That meant a lot to you, and talk about it, but I'm just curious, until that moment happened, did you have your mom saying, you need to bring me there, I need to meet that guy?
No, my mom is, she's very soft-spoken. She doesn't like attention. She was very excited to meet the president, but she was very nervous at the same time. And maybe he sensed her nervousness and thought, you know what, let me put her at ease and give her a kiss.
Mm.
And it really just kind of helped make things a lot easier. I mean, it just made her feel special.
Probably a moment she's never going to forget the rest of her life, I take it.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Do you have just as good things to say about the Bidens, covering the Bidens?
I do. You know, I did a couple trips, overseas trips with the VP, and then I did one trip to Cuba with Dr. Biden, and she was, and that was my first real overseas trip with her, so everything else had been day trips before that. And I just could not, you know, tell you how much fun and easygoing she was. And for him, he has the energy. I don't know where he gets his energy, but we used to say, don't let his Joe-mentum get going, because then you'll never stop. And Joe-mentum is a play with words of momentum.
Ah, of course. Actually, you created a lot of words. You created Obama-naught, too. We have that from you.
Yes, I'm good at making words up. How about that?
Well, now that I brought it up, tell our listeners what an Obama-naught is.
Sure. So an Obama-naught is anybody who has worked directly with the First Lady or the President, and they've taken that inspiration of working with them, and they've gone on to do other things that helps people or reaches people with a message. So that could be someone who's running for office now, or someone who's still working in government, someone who's written a book, or someone who is doing some type of social media engagement. So it's a wide variety, and it's a pretty broad cloth, but all these people, they all have stories, and they talk about why they got into politics, or why they got into government, and it all leads back to the President and First Lady. And they'll do great things, and they'll be the leaders in the future.
You also, obviously, had to deal with Sasha, Malia, and the dogs. And I imagine Mrs. Robinson, I imagine Michelle's mother.
Yeah.
Were the kids ever mischievous or anything? Or did they behave like first children should behave?
They behave like first children should behave. Come on, Paul, you know that.
I'm trying to get some news out of you.
Yeah, I'm sure there's news to be had. You know, in fact, you know, there's a book out called Becoming.
Yeah, I think it's written by Michelle Obama.
Yes. No, the kids are great. The girls were absolutely, you know, there's a picture in the book that I think I've mentioned before that we're in it's the first turkey pardoning, where the president has his hand up and he's about to pardon the turkey. And in the background is Sasha with her hands over her face. And it looks like, you know, she's not sure what's about to happen, but she doesn't want to witness it. And it looks like he's about to wring the turkey's neck at the same time. And, you know, it's a really funny picture, and it just kind of shows, you know, at the time, you know, the girls were really young at the beginning of the administration, and then there are these beautiful young ladies at the end of the administration, and it made me feel old just watching those pictures and watching them grow up. As I'm sure probably made those the president first lady feel.
I hear you.
But I'm more than positive they could not be prouder of those two girls.
I always wondered whether people who were, you know, maybe friendly with the Obamas. I mean, I knew Barack Obama certainly when he was a state senator and all that. You know, whether something magic happens when he became the president. I remember interviewing David Axelrod, who said the night that he won, the notion of calling him Barack was gone. He said, you simply just, at that point, said Mr. President, and that was it. I'm sort of curious, yeah, as you would see all these various people, even friends, whatever, friends from Chicago, Kwame Raoul, different people would make their way to the White House. Did anybody call him Barack, or was he? Did he become Mr. President to everybody, even his old friends?
In my presence, there's always Mr. President.
Mm.
And I tell you, when the president would play golf with his friends or basketball with his friends, he had one rule, which was, you know, don't treat me like I'm, you know, the president. Treat me like anybody else on the court or on the golf course. And I will say that his friends from high school or from before he became president, they had no problem treating him like that. And, you know, they would talk and give each other a hard time. And it was fun to watch. But the people who were, you know, friends with him after he became president could not separate the two people. And there was always Mr. President, and they were, you know, it was really kind of funny to watch.
Yeah, I'm sure. You know, I've been in the Oval Office a couple of times, and I have to say there's an feeling of austerity that when you're in any of these places. Does that ever wear off? I mean, 8 years later into this gig, and you're in the Oval Office, or you're in the Roosevelt Room, or you're wherever you are, did you ever go, eh, no big deal, I'm here again? Or is there always a sense of where you were?
So when I'm working in the room, I just don't have the bandwidth to kind of appreciate the moment, unless it's maybe something maybe historical happening at that time. But when I'm in the room by myself, setting up a light or breaking down or, you know, just have a few minutes before the president walks in, I do always have that every time I always have that sense of like wonder, like, wow, this room is, you know, a living museum, and this has, you know, there's so much history, you know, in these walls, and people have come and gone before me, and it's always appreciated. But it's not every day, but you know, whenever I was by myself, it would come on.
Well, we get to relive your life through your book. Yes, we did. Magnificent photos, Lawrence. I have to tell you, it's been such a pleasure getting to chat with you both on Politics Tonight and here. What a lucky guy you are to have had that position in history and to be able to tell the story of a presidency. And I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, who you are out there who's listening or paying attention or anything else. The bottom line is to have that opportunity to play that role in history is that's a once in a lifetime that will stay with you forever, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And I've said before that this book has no political bone in its body. And in fact, I have a dear friend who's a photographer for the Trump administration. And my advice to her is to take as many pictures as possible, because everything that happens is historic. And maybe someday she'll have a book.
I'm sure she will. And then I'll talk to her.
Of course. I'll set it up.
Thank you. The book is Yes, We Did. And to no surprise, it has a foreword by Barack Obama just to show how much he obviously appreciated and respect the work that you've done. Lawrence Jackson, amazing photographer. And you're back to the world of photography now, right? Just working with regular people.
I am freelancing, and I've done a few work on a couple of the campaigns for president. But right now it's just, you know, promoting the book and getting my name out there.
Well, congratulations. I'm glad to be part, at least, of helping you send the word out about the book, because beautiful it is indeed. And I'm so
Thank
glad
you.
Pete Souza hired you, and that you had that experience in history. The book is Yes, We Did. The author is Lawrence, the photographer and author is Lawrence Jackson. Congratulations, my friend. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Paul.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes, and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.